Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to have with me as a guest today by phone. We're working on that right now, as a matter of fact, I think. Jessica Walliser, as we talk with her about growing organic flowers, veggies, lawns, and more. We'll try to get into a lot give you a lot of information about organic growing as we visit with her today for the first hour of the program. Before we get to her, I also want to mention that we'll be talking with another author at noon today. So Rosemary Harris, a master gardener turned mystery writer, has a book called Pushing Up Daisies, and you'll learn some more about that. She's a master gardener herself, so it's kind of cool that she's written a mystery, and I enjoyed it, frankly. And so we asked her on, and she'll be on with us at afternoon. But for now, we'll be visiting with Jessica Walliser. She's the co-host of the Organic Gardeners on Sirius Satellite Radio Saturdays, and she's on KDKA in Pittsburgh Sunday mornings. She's the co-author with Doug Oster of Grow Organic, over 250 tips and ideas for growing flowers, veggies, lawns, and more. It's published by St. Lin's Press. Really pleased to have her with us today. They also collaborated on a book, which I also have in front of me, called A Gardener's Journal, Life with My Garden, and we'll visit with her about that, too. And, of course, we'll take your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or if you are in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Jessica Walliser with us by phone. Jessica, hi.
Good morning. How are you, Larry?
Well, I'm doing great. How are you?
I am wonderful. I am so thankful that spring is finally here. At least it is in Pennsylvania anyway.
Well, I'll tell you what. We had some snowflakes yesterday in Wisconsin, but the snow is almost completely gone. And isn't it great to be thinking, oh, finally we can get out and do some gardening?
It really is. And actually, the maples around here are starting to bud. And that, for me, is the number one sign of spring. And our pussy willow in the backyard is out and beautiful. And it just, it was a long winter, so I really needed it.
Oh, I know exactly what we had. Over 100 inches of snow in the southern Wisconsin area. So, and even more, well, about the same up north, I think, as well. So 100 inches of snow is a lot of snow.
That is a lot of snow, and I certainly can't complain about that. We had much less than that, but we had an awful lot of rain, and you know that means a lot of mud. And, you know, we have two dogs here at home, and we have a lot of ground just covered with mulch that they love to dig in. And so it has been a miserable winter as far as mopping the floors in the house goes, too.
Well, I tell you what, I've really enjoyed looking, going through your book, Grow Organic. It's a fun book with a lot of good information.
It really is. We, Doug and I have been together on air for almost 10 years, doing everything from little 5-minute spots on our local NPR affiliate all the way to doing full 2 and 3 hour shows every week on the weekends. And, you know, the show is called The Organic Gardeners. And what we found in approaching people about it was that they didn't know how to get started, that they didn't know the basics of what it really meant to be an organic gardener. And they have this kind of, you know, granola-eating, tree-hugging image of what an organic gardener was. And here we are, two very down-to-earth gardeners who, you know, there's nothing. I mean, yeah, I like trees, but I'm not going to run out and hug them. So
okay. We
wanted to write this book to really teach people how to simply transition your garden to organic care, and how to do it in a personable way. And that's what we're all about on the radio program, too. We want to make it approachable to people who are interested in going organic 100%, but we also want to encourage people who just want to take a few steps at a time as well. And that's why the book came out the way that it did. And that's really to just guide people with easy, simple techniques, and so that they can take the process and do it one step at a time.
Well, I tell you what, we have lots of gardeners listening on Friday. Our Friday program is called Garden Talk, so it's 90 minutes of talking about all things gardening, and we have lots of listeners, and they have lots of questions.
Great, good. Great, I love to hear that.
Well, I tell you what, every one of our lines is filled. I'll give the number again just in case somebody's listening and doesn't know it. It's 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And caller online is Matt, I believe, in Green Bay. Matt, hi. Good. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. How are you two today?
Great.
Very well, Matt. What's going on?
Well, I have a really simple question, and I have to find your book, first of all. But my wife and I just had our first child last fall, actually, and we have a garden, well, not a garden so much as a lawn that's infested with little red fire ants.
Okay.
And we're trying to come up with an organic solution so that our little boy can crawl around this summer without getting all bit up.
Right, yeah, and you know, fire ants...
I doubt that they're fire ants, though, man.
Yeah.
Well, whatever, little red...
They're little red ants, but they're not fire ants.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I don't believe fire ants have made it that far north.
No.
So, yeah. you know, it's crazy because ants really are a totally normal part of every ecological system that exists pretty much, except in the Antarctica, everywhere on the planet. So they're great decomposers. Some species help to pollinate. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I hate to tell you to just go ahead and blast them all and get rid of them all because they really do serve a purpose. However, if you have mounds of ants in a play area and they tend to sometimes gravitate like under swing sets and things like that, if you have bark or you have sand under there, they'll tend to make their nests there. If you have a hardcore nest like that that you want to get rid of, one of the products that you can use that's a great organic product, there are a whole class of them. They're all based on a biological insecticide that's called spinosad. And spinosad is actually a fermented bacteria, and it works really wonderfully. And it's labeled actually for fire ants, which is not necessarily a concern in Wisconsin, but for listeners further in the south and a lot of parts of the country that are dealing with fire ants, spinosad is a safe alternative to a lot of the chemical measures that people are sometimes resorting to. So if you have an individual mound like that, that's something you can do. We hear from a lot of people, too, who do, you know, they pour boiling water in it or vinegar in it or something like that to get rid of the nest. Some people will actually take a very big shovel and scoop and dig the nest out like that. If they're over the whole area, then what you might want to do is start looking at other reasons why they would be there. Because the ants like that normally build a colony. They don't just kind of spread out all over the place. So if you can find where their main colony is and take care of that, then you will take care of that problem.
Good luck. Thanks, Matt, for calling. Appreciate it. Beth in Eau Claire, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about sheep sorrel.
Okay.
Goes everywhere, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I left this place about 4 years ago, and our yard runs into, essentially, it's like a storm water detention park.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not lawn. That's like all kinds of weeds and things that the city does mow, but... And the question is, even if I find a way to attack all the sheep sorrel that's getting into our lawn and our perennial beds and our hedgerows...
are you going to be able to keep it out?
Yeah, I think there's a ready supply right on the edge of the yard at all times.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, is there a way to learn to live with it or something that...
Yeah,
I can do.
Yeah, I feel
other than pulling it up by all the fine little roots.
Yeah, which you won't get all of them. And what happens
is,
yeah, when you pull them out like that, and you every little fragment that you leave behind is going to make a whole new plant. You're
right.
Basically taking a lot of cuttings of that plant is what you're doing. So, and I feel for you on this because, we had an organic market farm, and we battled in our blueberry patch, actually, a terrible case, we'll call it a case, of this, it's a disease, of sheep sorrel that we really found to be a challenge. And one of the things that we did in there that worked really well was we used a newspaper mulch. And you just take the black and white sheets of your newspaper, and you can, if they're, you know, if it's a colored matte finish, you can use those as well. You don't want to use, like, the glossy colored pages because they're a different kind of ink. And what you do is you just take about 10 to 15 sheets of newspaper, and you lay that down around the base of the plants, and then you put your, whether you want to use shredded bark or mushroom soil or compost or whatever kind of organic mulch you want to put on top of that, and that will form a physical barrier that will keep them from coming up into that established bed.
Actually, though, that's what we have been doing for all of our mulching systems, and the sheep sorrel is crawling between the newspaper and the mulch.
It gets in between the mulch. Well, the good news about that is that does make it easier to pull out when you do that, because it's only going into an inch or two of mulch versus having roots going way down deep into the soil. So it makes it a little easier to pull out. One of the things that you could do is you could get a metal edging that would go around the outside of that bed. Now, sometimes they will skip over the metal edging or under the metal edging, but it really does help keep them out. And what you can do is then just every week or two, take a walk around that perimeter and see if it's jumping over or under and really catch it before it begins to take hold.
Mm-hmm.
There are some organic herbicides that are really wonderful, and there's more and more coming on the market every year. And their main active ingredients are clove oil and acetic acid, which is basically vinegar. And there's a bunch of different brand names. One's called Avenger. There's one called Perfectly Natural. There's one called Burnout. And these products work really good. Now, the thing with perennial weeds like sheep sorrel is that you sometimes have to apply them two or three times to really get down into the root system, and you need to do it when the sun is bright on a really hot day, and essentially what it does is it kind of like fries the plant, and mm-hmm. it works really, really quickly and works really, really well, and I'd sooner see you turn to those than turn to a glyphosate product, in an instance like that.
Good luck, Beth. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, today as we talk organic gardening with Jessica Walliser, who is co-host of The Organic Gardeners on Sirius Satellite Radio on Saturdays, and is author with her buddy Doug Oster of the book Grow Organic, Over 250 Tips and Ideas for Growing Flowers, Veggies, Lawns, and More. It's for first-timers and old-timers alike. So, good book. I've had a chance to look through it. Lori in Green Bay has a question for you, Jessica. So let's go there. Hi, Lori.
Well, good morning. I'm calling in regards to a really horrible earwig problem I tend to have. When I pick my ears of corn, there tends to be, anywhere from 10 to 20 of them gathered up at the base of that ear and at the base of my red cabbage. And I've really battled with them and would like to find out if there's anything organic I can use, and I will take my answer on the air. Thank you.
Okay. And you are in luck, because there's a really easy answer to earwigs. And I don't know, Larry, if you know, I actually have a new book coming out in the spring in May.
Oh, good.
Called Good Bug, Bad Bug, Who's Who, What They Do, and How to Manage Them Organically. And it basically highlights 24 pest insects, and earwigs is one of them, and then 14 beneficial insects, most of which are found all across the country. And in doing a lot of research for this book, in particular about earwigs, I found that, I've never myself had a major problem with them, except in lettuces. But apparently, in researching through a lot of cooperative extension agencies, earwigs are a tremendous problem for some people. And one of the things that, in doing this research, that I have found that they say is one of the best ways to effectively get rid of earwigs is corrugated cardboard. And you just take sheets of corrugated cardboard. You can do squares. You can do long rectangles so that they fit between the rows of your corn. And you put the corrugated cardboard out. And what happens is the earwigs will go in there in the morning, in late morning, to hide, because they take shelter during the daylight hours. And you do that very early in the season. And then you go out in the morning and you either shake them out of the tunnels and into a garbage bag or a can of soapy water, or you just throw the sheets of corrugated cardboard into a compost heap way far away from the vegetable garden. You can put them on a driveway and drive over them a couple of times to squish all the earwigs inside. It's basically a trap for them, and it's touted to be incredibly effective. And again, with that corn, you want to start doing it very early in the season, because obviously they have to climb up those corn plants to get into the corn silks. And so get them and around the cabbage plants as well, and they will go in and they will hide there during the daylight hours, and then it's real easy to dispose of them.
So you just lay it out on the ground?
Lay it out on the ground level, and they will crawl right into the tunnels of the corrugated cardboard. Yep.
Very cool.
Isn't that cool? And people do it with newspaper, too. Like, they will wrap up a newspaper into a tube, not just one sheet, but a whole newspaper section, basically. Wrap that into a sheet and leave the ends open. And what they do then is they kind of crawl into the tunnels of the newspaper, and then they throw those away as well. But I've read that the cardboard works much better.
That's a great – I had never heard that idea.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a good one.
Learn something new every day.
How about that?
That's great. Jessica Wallace, our guest today, co-author with Doug Oster of Grow Organic, over 250 tips and ideas for growing flowers, veggies, lawns, and more. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Jessica Walliser today about her book, Growing Organic. Really pleased to have her with us today. Certainly you can join in with your questions as we move along at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Karen in Milwaukee, I believe, is up next. So let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Thanks.
Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, I hope nobody's eating lunch or anything. I've got a smelly and stinky, crappy subject.
Okay.
I have a square foot vegetable garden. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book that goes along with the gardening method, it's not really clear about rabbit compost.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbit droppings.
I have pet rabbits. And I know with cow manure, because of the size and everything, you're supposed to make either a manure tea or compost it really good.
Mm-hmm.
But with the bunny manure, do I have to treat that the same, or should I?
Yeah,
there's a safety factor with every animal manure. And the guides that I like to follow are actually ones that are set out by the National Organic Standards. And this they do for human safety. And it's really, really important when you're dealing with any animal manures. Ideally, they should be composted first. So you would want to take that manure of the rabbits and the bedding and mix it into your regular compost pile and let it fully break down. And you know what good quality finished compost looks like. That's the best way to do it, to make sure that you're eliminating any pathogens. The second best way to do it is if you want to use just that manure in the garden, is it needs to be at a minimum of 120 days aged before it's added into the garden. I even say more, especially if you're growing food crops, because why be sorry?
Right.
But 120 days is the minimum for it. But the more the better. And with rabbit manure, it's really, fairly concentrated stuff. So you can go overboard on it, and you can end up with too much nitrogen in the soil. And what happens when you have too much nitrogen in the soil and turn it goes into the plants, you have all this wonderful, lush, green growth, and it looks fabulous, but it's also very, very inviting to pests. And you will find that you have more aphids, you have more whiteflies, and you have a lot more of other pests when you have plants that are fed too much nitrogen. So go lean on the use of the rabbit manure, and I would sooner see you put it into your compost pile first and let it be fully rotted.
Okay. That would even explain why at the base of my one clematis that I've had for years, where a bunny just happened to reside, it's got green foliage. It's gorgeous. It never gets any flowers.
Yeah. Too much nitrogen.
Yep.
Good luck. Thanks, Karen. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call or email us, too, at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Dave in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. Hi, Dave.
Good day. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a pesterous question. My neighbor has a untreated ground right by our fence and decided to plant Creeping Charlie.
Well, it planted it?
Yes, planted it. I know, that's why I said, you planted it?
Yeah, I would say on purpose.
It has decided to creep into my yard approximately 20 feet during the summer, last summer,
mm-hmm.
and it has destroyed my lawn.
Yeah.
I have tried the propane torch, burning it. I have tried pulling it out, which is an endless process.
Mm-hmm.
Any ideas?
Yeah. Here's two possible, I'm not going to call them solutions, but aids for you and ideas for you that you can use. One would be the same thing I used with that caller earlier who was talking about the sheep sorrel, and that is to get some metal edging in there between your property and his property. And make sure that metal edging sticks a little bit above the soil surface so that the Creeping Charlie can't come out over it. Now, it still might do that. And what you'll have to do is walk that line every couple of weeks to make sure that the creeping Charlie isn't coming over that. For what is existing in your lawn, you actually have asked this question at the most perfect time, because what we tell people to do is to go out in, usually for our area here in Pennsylvania, we're zone 6, so I usually say around early to the middle of March. So for you guys, we're probably talking about the end of March into early mid-April. Mm-hmm. You go out with a metal leaf rake that has a spring, one of those spring leaf rakes.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually go out now and you do quick, short, brisk strokes through that area of the lawn where the creeping Charlie is growing. And what will happen is the roots are very inclined to pull out this time of year, and you will just pull out the big lines of creeping Charlie in your garden by doing it with short, quick strokes of that rake, and it pulls right out. And then what you want to do is you want to overseed that area. As soon as the right time for planting grass seed in your area, you want to overseed so that you're getting lawn in there to help displace and shade out those any little pieces of creeping Charlie that remain. And because you have, I think you said, a 20-foot area of it there,
yeah,
this year, and then you're going to want to probably have to do that again next spring until you get it under control. Also, creeping Charlie can be a sign of certain fertility issues in your soil. So you're going to want to get the lawn soil tested. Test for the pH, test for nutrient content, and sometimes simply tweaking your fertilization program or liming program on your lawn can be enough to make an inhospitable environment for creeping Charlie, and it's very, very effective in controlling it as well.
But if you don't put that barrier up, that edge up, it's just going to keep coming right.
Exactly, exactly. You've got to get a physical barrier in there to keep it from coming over.
Thanks for calling, Dave. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Mary in Whitewater, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I told your screener that I wanted to talk about organic fungicides, but I also want to throw in a couple organic insecticides also, if that's okay.
Okay.
I have a small urban garden, and I don't have much room to rotate. So pretty much my tomatoes and peppers have to go in the same places,
mm-hmm,
with minimal rotating. And I've been trying to use organic standards for products, and most of my products I have purchased from a place that several horticulturists on this program have recommended, which is Gardens Alive.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been using Soap Shield,
mm-hmm,
and I've been using Plant Guardian,
mm-hmm,
biofungicide,
mm-hmm,
and I've been using NZ-Rot, Blossom End Rot Spray.
Mm-hmm.
Without much luck, and these are extremely expensive products. I've also used some of their organic fertilizers along with composted manure and compost and leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as insecticides go, I haven't had that much problem with bugs except for Japanese beetles.
Mm-hmm.
But I have purchased the Bullseye bioinsecticide,
mm-hmm,
and when it arrived, I read that the product is toxic to bees,
mm-hmm,
so I didn't use it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Piola, which I have used I used those on Japanese beetles. It didn't do very well,
mm-hmm,
and I use Oil Away Supreme insecticidal oil as an early spray on fruit trees.
Okay, well, let me take over here a little bit, if you don't mind, by asking you just a couple of quick questions. And the first is, you were describing all these products that you're using for your tomatoes, the Blossom End spray, and all that kind of stuff. Have you made a proper identification of the disease that you're dealing with on your tomatoes? Is it a blight? What is it?
I have, I think, every possible fungus that can attack.
Okay.
From yellowing leaves to black spots to powdery mildew.
Okay.
And the blossom end rot also.
Okay. Well, let's start with some very first steps for you. And the very first step for me, since you have such a small area and you can't really practice a good rotation, would be to very carefully select that the varieties that you plant, especially of tomatoes, really important, mm, that you choose varieties that are resistant to blight, whether it's early blight or late blight or wilts or fungus. really important that you talk to whoever you're buying your seeds from or whoever you're buying your plants from. Don't just go into the nursery and buy what they have. You want to do some research. You want to grow varieties that are naturally resistant. That is your first line of defense. Your second line of defense is many of these fungal issues, as you know from this conversation, are in the soil. They live in the soil. So what you have to do is immediately after planting your plants is you must put a physical barrier between the soil surface and your plants. This is simply a layer of mulch, and one of the most effective ones that I think to prevent those spores from splashing up onto the leaves is, again, those sheets of about 10 sheets of newspaper. The day that you plant those tomatoes, get 10 sheets of newspaper on top of the soil surface and then cover it with straw or hay, and about 2 to 3 inches thick of straw or hay. Make sure the plants are well watered before you put all this mulch down. And what that does is that will prevent that fungus from splashing up onto the leaves. So prevention in all things garden, whether you're organic or conventional, the prevention is number one. And that's how you're going to do it. Choose a variety and put that barrier in between the plants. Once you have it and you start seeing those yellowing leaves, those leaves immediately come off of the plant. They don't go into the compost pile. They get burned. They get thrown away. Toss them into the woods or whatever. Don't put them into your compost pile and don't let them stay on the plants. That's going to help you out as well. Okay? Go ahead.
Just going to say one other thing. Just to go along with it, I sometimes see gardeners planting their tomatoes too closely together.
Mm-hmm.
And that can create some issues for the plants as well.
Air circulation is key. If you are growing a large variety of tomato, they should be at a minimum 5-6 feet apart. And stake them up off of the ground. Again, keeping them, the contact from the ground. You want to minimize that. Japanese beetles they're a bear, and they are best targeted in their larval stage, which we all know are those little white grubs that munch mm-hmm. on the roots of your plants and on the roots of your turf grass. And that's where they're most vulnerable because they can't fly away. So you want to target them. And now what most of the research is saying that the most effective control for the grubs of Japanese beetles is beneficial nematodes. And these beneficial nematodes are sold either as a powder or in a sponge. And there's billions of these living nematodes. And you mix them with water and you actually use it as a hose end sprayer onto your lawn. And they get down into the soil, and they actually seek out those grubs, and they go in and they destroy them and they kill them. And you just have to do that once a year, twice a year if it's a really incredibly bad infestation, but really only once a year. Now, that's not going to stop if your neighbor doesn't do it. That's not going to stop his Japanese beetle from coming over into your yard. So sometimes we do have to target them as adults. And I think that the caller said that's what she used Piola for. And Piola is a mixture of canola oil and pyrethrins, which are an insecticide based on a species of chrysanthemum. I don't think that's a hugely effective control for Japanese beetles. I prefer a product based on neem oil, and it's NEEM, and that's made from the seeds of a tropically grown tree called the neem tree. And I found that to be very effective against adult Japanese beetles.
What about a rotenone pyrethrins?
Personally, I highly do not ever recommend rotenone because there have been some studies that have linked it to Parkinson's disease. And here's the thing that people have to realize. When something is labeled organic, a product is labeled organic or all natural, that doesn't mean that it doesn't have its negatives. We talk about some of them damaging bees, and you brought one up earlier, and I think it was bullseye that you had brought up. They can harm bees. Some of them can harm aquatic life. So you have to really carefully read the label instructions, and before you reach for any of those products, you have to do all the steps in advance of that. You have to follow all the preventative measures and choose resistant varieties, and all that kind of stuff should go first. That turning to that product, even if it is an organic one, should still be your very, very last step. The goal in it all should be to build healthy plants that have healthy immune systems and are able to ward off attacks of pests and diseases. That should be the key in how you garden. You should look at building healthy soil, look at raising healthy plants, and that in turn will lead to natural disease and pest resistance.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Mary. Appreciate it. More callers online. Let's go to Amber next in Winneconne. Hi, Amber.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking me. I'm calling because my grandmother told me to sprinkle, we burn wood in our home, and she said to sprinkle the ash in the garden. And so I told my husband to make sure he did that. And I just walked outside this past weekend and saw that pretty much the whole winter he's been throwing ash in the garden. Mm. And I don't know if that is a bad thing. There's like a good, you know, foot of ash.
Oh, my
God.
I know. And now I'm like, what did you? And he's like, oh, I thought I was doing a good thing.
Ooh.
And, yeah, so now, like, do I need to take out a
get
ton
the
of
shovel
it?
Out.
Yeah.
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 Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
How much should I take out?
When I generally recommend wood ashes, I say to put them in the compost pile first. And you put them in the compost even very sparingly at that point, because you can really alter the pH of your soil. That's the biggest problem that you get from using wood ash, is you can screw up the pH of your soil. And pH, which is the measure of the acidity or alkalinity of your soil, all of the nutrients that exist in your soil, whether or not they're taken up by plants, is completely dependent on the soil pH. So if you have the wrong pH, you can put on all the nutrients you want, but your plants can't get it. So pH is, if there's one thing you know about your soil, pH is the number to know. And adding that quantity especially of ashes is really going to mess with your pH. So I would get as many off of there as possible, and then I would make sure that you get a soil test done this spring to find out what that pH is and see if you need to adjust it.
Right, 'cause I'd never had a problem with this soil before. I mean,
yeah.
And now I'm like, when I walked out there, I'm like, and he has sawdust in there as well.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't rototill it in, pretty much?
No, I would try to get it off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez, great. you mean I'm going to make him do that, right?
I was just going to say I would make him do it.
Okay, well, thanks for your help.
Yeah, thanks, Amber. Yeah, you got 12 inches of ash on there. I'd say remove, about 12 inches.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bob in Wauwatosa, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. I've got a question about raised gardens. We want to put in a raised garden this spring before it's time to plant tomatoes. And I'm a little concerned about the quality of bags of topsoil that one can buy at the garden centers. I'd like to be able to get topsoil to put in this raised garden, along with, you know, some sand and some organic matter such as bags of cow manure or sheep manure.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get materials that don't contain things like heavy metals. How
yes.
can one? How can one know what one is buying?
Right. Yeah. This is extremely difficult because nowhere on that bag do they have to say what's contained inside.
That's right.
Yeah. What you're going to want to look for is a particular stamp of approval when you buy a bag of either mulch or organic soil amendments or topsoil. If it comes in a bag, there's an important seal that you want to look for, and that is the seal of the Mulch and Soil Council. And the Mulch and Soil Council seal of approval, it's actually an organization that's partnered with the Garden Writers Association of America. And what they do is they actually test a lot of these products to make sure that they're not made from things like pallets that have contained, were made of treated lumber or that have carried chemicals and that there's a chemical residue in there, that you're not buying something that has so much nitrogen in it that it's going to burn your plants. So that's one seal of approval that you can start with. There's also your own personal seal of approval. If you are going to a good quality, in most cases, family-run nursery, they will not have a problem with you asking to open up one of those bags and look at what's inside. If you're talking about bagged compost or bagged, now they're calling it soil conditioners in a lot of cases, you want to feel it. You want to smell it. What does it look like? Because in some instances, you'll buy a bag of something labeled as compost, and you open it up, and it's a bag of bark chips. That is not compost. So, you know, you need to smell it, you need to feel it, you need to, and any good nursery will let you do that without a problem. So you have to feel good about it. Another thing that I don't know if you have a local farmer's market close to you, but
yeah.
If there's an organic farmer there, a certified organic farmer, you may talk to them about buying a quantity of topsoil from them, because if they're doing any construction where they, maybe they're building a high tunnel or a greenhouse or something, and they're doing any excavation, they may be willing to sell you what, if they're certified organic, it's contaminant-free soil, you know, they may be willing to sell you a couple of bags of very good quality topsoil right off their farm. So that's another option for you
what
as well.
What a great idea.
That's great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Bob, appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. We finally have some open lines, so we can get you on pretty quickly, so give us a call. Dennis in Platteville is up next. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. Say, years ago, my mother used to be able to grow a beautiful garden around walnut trees. And I, being a young man and not liking gardening very much, never wrote down or learned what it was that she put in the soil to make it compatible with tomatoes and carrots and all the other things that make a garden worth having.
You know, I don't know anything that you can put in a soil around walnut trees that would actually make any difference. Do you?
I don't. And actually, juglone is the compound that black walnuts produce that prevents other things from growing underneath. And not only is it in the root system, but it's also in all the leaves and the walnuts and the branches that fall down off of the tree. So you have to be extremely religious about collecting all of the things that fall off of those trees. Growing in raised beds is a start when you're dealing with black walnuts, although their root systems will eventually come up into the raised beds from underneath. But that's a start. But there is nothing that I know of, just like you, Larry, that you can put in there that will neutralize that juglone.
You have to be well beyond the drip line of the tree, well beyond it, you know, especially with something like tomatoes.
Yes.
So
there are plants that you can grow, though, that are, I don't want to know if the resistant is the word, but that will tolerate juglone in the soil, things like mugo pines, some species of hosta, some species of viburnums. But vegetable gardening, there's not a whole lot that I know of that will grow under under walnut trees.
And not only that, after you, if you chop the walnut tree down, that juglone stays in the soil for several years, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, if the caller finds out what it was that his mother did, he could make a lot of money on that.
Oh, yeah. Let us know if you ever find out, Dennis, for sure. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jessica Welliser, our guest today, author with Doug Oster of Grow Organic, visiting with us here on A Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking organic gardening today with Jessica Welliser, who, with Doug Oster, is author of Grow Organic, over 250 tips and ideas for growing flowers, veggies, lawns, and more. Really pleased to have her with us today. Our last caller mentioned trees, and that reminded me, Sharon, I heard from Sharon Morrissey, and who is the consumer horticulture agent for Milwaukee County. And there is an Arbor Day celebration at Berner Botanical Gardens and the Weir Nature Center on April 19th and 20th that she's going to be participating in. So she wanted me to be sure to mention that. And she does a great job and really happy to be able to mention that. And Jessica, I also want to mention that Saturday, April 5th, you're going to be in Wisconsin.
I am. I'm going to be at the Green Bay Botanical Garden for their annual spring symposium.
Have you visited the garden before?
You know, I haven't, and I've only been to Green Bay one time to visit some friends, and I cannot wait to see it. I hope that something is up and blooming and doing something by April 5th.
I tell you what, it's a lovely, lovely garden, and you're really going to enjoy it.
Oh, great. I'm looking forward to it so much.
So that's the 5th of April, Saturday the 5th?
Mm-hmm, Saturday the 5th, yes, and I'll be giving two lectures throughout the course of the day. One will be just before lunch, where we're going to talk about transitioning your garden to organic care. And I'm basically going to hand attendees a really easy step-by-step process that you can use to transition to basically wean your garden off of chemicals and onto natural organic practices. And then after lunch, I'm going to give another series of steps, and that one is called 6 Steps to a Pest-Free Garden Organically. And I'll talk about biological, botanical, physical, mechanical controls for pests that are really practical things that you can do to help control some of the diseases and some of the insect pests that plague our gardens.
Well, that's wonderful, and I think I was just going to try and go online and take a look. I think if someone goes to the website, you can get information on how to find out more about that event. I know Kelly Hartman at the garden is the person probably to contact, but I think their number is 920-491-3691. But if you type in Green Bay Botanical Garden, you're probably going to come up with the exact information on how to get involved. So I really wanted to mention that because that's going to be a lot of fun.
It is going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm glad that Kelly has asked me to give these two lectures in particular because they really do go hand in hand. Everybody always wants to know immediately when you talk about organic gardening, you know, what can I use to control pests? And so I'm glad that we're going to be talking about that, but I'm glad that we're starting it out with transitioning to organic care because there's so many steps. Again, before you get to that pest part, there's so many steps that you need to do to transition yourself to organic care.
Yeah, and I just went online, and I'm sure there's an events area on the Green Bay Botanical Garden website. Just go to that, and you'll find out some more about Jessica and her presentation and all the other things going on during that day. Jesse in Madison is waiting to talk, so let's go there. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Jessica. What a great, great program. Thank you so much for having this. And, Jessica, I'm really excited about your book.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Two big problems, common problems, I'm sure everybody has it practically, snow on the mountain and that wild campanula. I have a plethora of it. I've had it for years and years and years. I cannot get rid of it. And, I'm getting old. I don't want to be, I can't do what I used to be doing. And so I need a system that's going to control it.
Yeah.
And one of the things that is really disturbing about it is that I understand that the wild campanula, I think you probably know what I'm talking about, right? It's this purple flower with the bells on the stem, and it just spreads. It is so invasive. But it gets worse when you disturb the soil, and I have been digging it out for probably 10 years. Yeah, not knowing that every time I dig, I'm making
yeah.
it worse.
Making it worse, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's how I've been getting rid of my snow on the mountain, and that is not a successful strategy. So I'm hoping you have something.
Yeah, those are not two plants that we traditionally have to battle here in Pennsylvania, but I can give you some techniques that we recommend for most perennial weeds. This could be anything from Canadian thistle, which are big ones around here, to the creeping Charlie that we talked about earlier. And that is, again, that barrier, that physical barrier on top of the soil surface in the form of that newspaper with the mulch on top. Those organic herbicides are another choice for you, the ones that are based on clove oil and acetic acid, although it may take one or two applications to really get down deep into the roots. They aren't.
Do you have names of those?
There's a couple different brand names. One is Burnout.
Okay.
There's another one that's called Nature's Avenger, which cracks me up.
That sounds
Nature's
wrong.
Avenger, and one I think it's called Perfectly Natural Weed and Grass Killer. And I think that these products are even starting to show up on the shelves of some big box stores, which I'd sooner see you go and support one of your local nurseries.
I will.
But if the only place you can find it is at a big box, I'd rather see you use it than use some of the conventional products. But they are non-selective, so if those plants are growing in amongst other perennial or things like that, and that product comes in contact with the foliage of anything else, it's going to harm that plant as well. So you have to be very careful about how you apply it. There is really, unfortunately, with a lot of weeds, no substitute to good, manual removal of weeds. And in a lot of cases, it works really effectively. However, when you're talking about a plant that has a fibrous root system like that, that new babies will just spring out, you have to be very, very careful about how much you disturb the soil when you're digging them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tiny little bits of the root system, and you've got a whole new set of plants.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
Do you have time for one more question?
Okay.
I have, we had a... our lead pipes were removed, and when they did that, they shot a bullet through the soil, you know. So I had a redbud tree and a cranberry bush viburnum that were in line. I don't know if it was the bullet that did it, but anyway, the redbud died of what I think was a canker, and I lost one of my cranberry bush viburnums, two also of the same thing, slow yellowing and die off of a branch, and then it would be the next branch and then the next branch. So now I need to replant, and I want to replant a tree. Can I?
Why not?
Because of the canker in the soil. I don't know what canker is.
I would choose different species to plant there.
Yeah.
I'm not an arborist, so you know, it's very hard to make a diagnosis of something like that, you know, on the phone without having a good look at the plant, a good look at the root system. But I know around here when we talk about red buds, we talk about plants with a limited lifespan in the first place. Red buds are not a tree that's going to live for generations and generations. Sometimes we only get 12 or 15, maybe 20 years at most out of them. So we will have a natural die off on the limbs and then eventually of the whole plant. It could also be something that is in the soil that would affect the root system, and then obviously the symptoms would show up above the ground. So if you're going to replant in that area, and I'm with Larry, I certainly don't see why you couldn't, but I would choose a different species of plant. So don't go putting another redbud in there, and don't go putting another cranberry viburnum. Choose a completely different species, and you should not have a problem with it.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Jesse,
Thank you for calling.
Jermet in Harrisville. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry and Jessica.
Good morning.
I have a terrible problem with moles and shrews in my yard, in my lawn.
Mm-hmm.
And my neighbors also have them. Is there something we can do or that you would suggest?
Moles can be a good sign or a bad sign.
Oh, yeah.
They are insectivores, moles will not eat the roots of your plants. Voles will. Voles look more like little mice.
Right.
Moles will not. They only eat insects. So they're after one of two things. They're either after grubs, which would be great because I'd way rather have moles than a lot of grubs, or they're after earthworms, which is also says you have a good, healthy earthworm population. So that's not an entirely bad thing either. But nobody likes the tunnels that they and the raised ridges and things that they create in your lawn. Here's a really easy and old-fashioned, simple solution to get rid of those moles. And it is so effective that it's crazy, and it seems silly that more people don't know about it. But it's a castor oil spray, and you can actually make it yourself. And what you do is you go to the pharmacy and you get good old-fashioned castor oil, just pure castor oil, and you put about 4 tablespoons of castor oil to 1 gallon of water. And then you put in just a few drops of liquid dishwashing detergent, unscented liquid dishwashing detergent, like Dawn or whatever brand that you use, and you agitate that. And then what you do is you spray that into the lawn area where you have the moles. And you do that every, basically about 7 to 10 days until you stop seeing evidence of the moles. They are extremely just do not like at all castor oil, because really, who does? And it drives them away, and it works incredibly well, and it also works for voles, which will eat your plants. And you just keep spraying it on that area every 7 to 10 days, and most often you'll do maybe 3 or 4 applications of it, and they're out of town.
Wow, I'll try that. That sounds really easy to do.
Give it a shot, but you have to keep after it a little bit. Just don't do it once.
Right.
I will do that. My yard is nothing but hills, and so
okay.
This should really help. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Tom in Maplewood, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hey, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've got probably a simple question, but it's been a problem for me. About 3 years ago, I bought a lake place in northwestern Wisconsin. Not some place we live, but if we're lucky, we get there 3 days a week. They had to do some digging in the yard, which, of course, slopes towards the lake, and sandy soil. And for the life of me, I can't get grass to grow there. I mean, maybe it's because we're only there a few days a week to water it or whatever. But is there do you have any ideas how to get some grass to grow there to avoid the erosion that I'm seeing?
Does it have to be grass?
Well, you know what? It's one of those things where, you know, I suppose, you know, chokecherry bushes or something is a better idea, but it's in an area that gives us access to the lake, and I don't really want to obstruct it.
Well, how about a ground cover of some sort?
Like what?
Gosh, what are favorites up there for you, Larry? Do you do myrtle? Do you do?
Yeah, sure.
Myrtle, I tell you, creeping thyme. Can I refer him to a website?
Absolutely.
Okay, there's a great website, and it's www.steppables.com. Steppables. It's a great little company owned by this really fabulous woman, and what they do is they specialize in ground covers. And you go to that website, and it actually asks you all these questions. What kind of soil do you have? What are the exposure conditions? What height plant are you looking for? What kind of foot traffic is it going to get? Do you want something that's evergreen? Do you want it to flower or not flower? And what it does then is it comes up with a bunch of plants that are good solutions to your problem and that are alternatives to grass, which, you know, I'd way rather see you use a ground cover there. It's going to be prettier. It's going to diversify the habitat. You won't have to mow it all the time. You get flowers, so you're going to increase your pollinators and have all these wonderful creatures around your yard and around that area. And you'll still, with plants, and you let them know how much foot traffic it can handle. Some of them you can use on your driveway, and you can drive your car over them every day. And that's a way better driveway than asphalt. So it's a great website, and it will give you some good choices for that area.
Great idea. I'll take a look at it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Boy, this has been a lot of fun, Jessica.
Has it been an hour?
an hour flies by really fast on this program.
It really does.
I appreciate it so much, and I hope you'll come back and be with us again. We'd love to have you.
Anytime, Larry. This was so much fun. It's always great to talk to people out of your own gardening zone. And a lot of these questions were way better than some of the ones we get on the Sirius program dealing with California plants and things like that. So Arizona is even harder.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you so much, Larry. Take care.
Take care. Jessica Walliser, along with Doug Oster, has written Grow Organic, over 250 tips and ideas for growing flowers, veggies, lawns, and more. A real pleasure to have her with us today. And we'll try and get her back, and we'll do it again with her. Coming up afternoon, we'll be taking a look at a new mystery book written by a master gardener. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.